You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the United States of War. The U.S. has been waging wars for all but about a dozen years in its 250-year history, some of those wars genocidal.
It's a particularly genocidal kind of warfare that the U.S. military embarks upon in its conquest of lands across North America. This genocide becomes a critical feature of the expansion of the United States, of the U.S. as an empire, of U.S. wars. The racism underlying U.S. wars has remained a feature of U.S. wars to this day. The vast majority of wars the U.S. military has fought have been against people of color around the world.
Military bases make America's wars and its nuclear weapons arsenal possible.
Of course, the first bomb was in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and the second two were in Japan, and they needed someplace for the fourth and fifth test. They wanted someplace that was really far away from everything. And they looked around, and there in the Marshall Islands, way off in the corner, was Bikini Atoll. It was perfect.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. An astonishing fact. In the 248 years since America became an independent state back in 1776, the American Republic has only been at peace for 12 years of peace out of almost 250. The United States of War, you could call it. David Vine does. Vine, a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., has recently completed the third in a trilogy of books about permanent war as an American way of life and about the role military bases play in war's pursuit across North America at first, then around the world. I reached David Vine in Oakland, California. America has been at war for all but 11 years since 1776. How come? Why? What is it about America?
That's the basic question that my book, The United States of War, tries to take on. I began the research for The United States of War despite having studied the issue for around two decades. I began the book thinking that the period of constant war since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, following the attacks of 9/11, I began thinking that period in U.S. history was somehow exceptional, that the United States had waged war in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Syria and Yemen and Somalia and beyond. And of course, that so-called war on terror continues to this day, while the United States Biden administration has also, of course, gotten involved in other wars that I'm sure we'll talk about. But I came to realize, as I conducted research for the United States of War, that, of course, there was nothing particularly exceptional about the period of constant war since 2001. There are some distinctive features and what I call a kind of hyper-imperialism that the United States has embraced in the post 9/11 era. But the United States, as you said, the US military has been involved in some kind of war or combat in all but around 11 years in US history. And why has the United States been involved in constant warfare, basically, since independence? And what I explore and what I say in the United States of War is that the United States government and U.S. elites in particular, who control the U.S. government, so U.S. politicians and other economic elites who have disproportionate influence over what the United States government does, has created a kind of war machine, created an empire, and U.S. leaders in the earliest days of the country consciously modeled the United States after the European empires, and the United States comes to succeed the empires of Britain and France, for example, and eventually to eclipse their power, of course, by the late 19th century and early 20th century. The United States becomes an expanding empire that expands from 13 colonies on the East Coast all the way across the continent and then around the globe. First, of course, with colonies in the Philippines, Puerto Rico, de facto colony in Cuba.
And so, I mean, it would seem to me that the conclusion from what you've been saying is that war fighting is the natural consequence of being an empire, right? I mean, the Romans were constantly at war because they had an empire, and there's never been an empire as powerful as the United States, certainly not since World War II. And so, but even before, it always had that ambition, and empires wage war.
Yes, I think that is an important part of the analysis. What you see is a United States empire expanding around the globe and expanding after World War II, in particular with an unprecedented collection of military bases that are portrayed often as defensive in nature, but that have advanced the interests of U.S. elites. And that's what you see since independence, that this long series of wars has not just been for war's sake, but has invariably advanced the interests of particular U.S. corporations or U.S. elites. The expansion across the continent, of course, was not an act of God or manifest destiny or inevitable or an act of nature. This was an act that advanced the interests of particular U.S. elites and to the U.S. colonists who participated in the colonization of Native American lands and helped expand the United States across the continent. So you see wars, of course, benefiting a whole range of actors and corporations. In more recent times, especially since World War II, you see the emergence of a military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower named it. This confluence of power, of weapons manufacturers and other military contractors, of the military itself, and of members of Congress. This military-industrial complex has further put the United States on a path of perpetual war because of the obscene profits to be made off war that, of course, have been a part of war making since the times of ancient Rome and Greece and empires past, but in the post-World War II era have allowed a few weapons manufacturers in particular to make obscene profits while millions, literally millions, suffer.
Now, those first wars, let's back up a bit, because America's war-fighting character and modus really began almost immediately. I mean, even before 1776, Americans, those colonists, were killing Indians. But post-1776 and the push westwards out of those 13 colonies westwards, you spend many pages in your book talking about all those wars against scores of different First Nations peoples up and down the eastern seaboard and across the Ohio River and across to the Pacific. Boy, oh boy, were there a lot of wars. And they were all accompanied by and propelled by the construction of forts, which were those first bases. Talk about this.
The United States military has fought wars and engaged in combat with somewhere around 135 distinct peoples and nations in its history, including, as you noted, scores of Native American peoples and nations. And there was essentially permanent, constant warfare between the U.S. military and Native American peoples from around the time of the founding, including during the War for Independence, through the end of the 19th century. And indeed, as I show in my book, The United States of War, this history predates the founding of the United States as a country. And indeed, we need to look to the way, and again, in which the U.S. government follows the imperial powers of Britain, France, and Spain and their attempts to conquer lands in North America and in the Americas more broadly. The colonists indeed come from a tradition of colonizers and war fighters. And it's a particularly genocidal kind of warfare that the U.S. military embarks upon in its conquest of lands across North America. And indeed, this genocide becomes a critical feature of the expansion of the United States, of the U.S. as an empire, of U.S. wars. And of course, the racist nature of that genocide is critical to underline. The racism underlying U.S. wars, of course, has remained a feature of U.S. wars to this day. The vast majority of wars the U.S. military has fought have been against people of color around the world. And race and the idea of race, the socially constructed idea of race and racism have fueled U.S. war making, have legitimized it, and made it possible in a whole variety of ways.
But there was this synergy between the westward expansion of American colonists relentlessly westward, you know, across the Appalachians, the Alleghenies, and to the Ohio River and into the prairies and on and on and on, you know, Lewis and Clark and all the rest of it, establishing forts. It's interesting your point here that there are 800 place names in the United States with the word fort on it. And, you know, I grew up in New York City on the east side of the Hudson River and across the other side of the George Washington Bridge is Fort Lee, which is how many times I've been to Fort Lee. But all these forts were established, and they served multiple purposes to support expansion, but also to help wage war against First Nations people. Talk about this a bit.
Yeah, the major theme of the United States of War is the construction of bases abroad, bases outside U.S. territory. And this is a long-term imperial pattern. Empires through history have tended to build bases outside their own territory, largely to advance interest of conquest, to advance economic interests, and to seize land, both for the sake of real estate gains and for the sake of economic activity that can be conducted on seized, conquered lands. So U.S. bases, the first U.S. bases abroad, are indeed U.S. Army forts that played a critical role in the conquest of territories across the continent. As one historian called it, the U.S. Army becomes the pry bar for colonization and conquest, and U.S. Army forts that dotted the land across North America allow that conquest, allow that pry bar pry Native American peoples off their lands, to displace them, to dispossess them, and of course to murder millions.
These forts were, on the one hand, they were places of commerce where Native peoples could come and trade, but at the same time they were outposts for the American military who would venture out and kill Native people.
Yeah, they played complicated roles, and of course different Native American peoples played different and complicated roles in the process of U.S. colonization. Of course, some were allied with the U.S. government at times, including in the fight against Britain, both in the War for Independence and in the War of 1812. But indeed, the bases were complicated places as the westward expansion, the westward conquest, the westward colonization progressed. And they were indeed, and not always, but often, places of commerce. They were kinds of expressions of an early version of the military-industrial complex, where individual economic interests, businesses, elites, and not so elites could make money off bases and provisioning them. But they were critically, as bases abroad tend to be, they were launch pads for further conquest, for offensive military actions against Native American peoples that again led to the dispossession, displacement, and death of millions across the continent.
And I would wager that most Americans, I mean, you ask any American, they're all familiar with these places that have fort in them, right? You know, Fort Leavenworth, Fort Jackson, Fort Washington, Fort Lee. I mean, they just go on and on. You've got a figure, in an image in your book with the United States just peppered with old forts. They're all over the place. And Americans take this for granted, but they're not really aware of what all those forts were all about.
Exactly. The history is, in a way, is one of my mentors and an amazing scholar and activist around U.S. militarism, Catherine Lutz, has said that this is history hidden in plain sight. The names, the forts are still peppering the continent, but most people don't think about the history and the conquest and colonization that those bases, those forts enabled. And that's because we're not particularly taught that history. The history of U.S. wars that most of us are taught in the United States is a celebratory history, one that glorifies war, rather than pointing to the death and destruction that U.S. wars have caused, including to U.S. Americans, the soldiers and other military personnel who've died, the family members who have suffered as a result of U.S. wars. But indeed, this history is hidden in plain sight. The same is true with the history of the United States as an empire. You come from the empire state. If you think about why it's called that, or there's a train that I'm a big fan of Amtrak, actually, for all its flaws and problems. And there's a train line called the Empire Builder. There are all these signs of the empire that the United States is and has been since independence, as well as the conquest that U.S. Army forts enabled.
I want to ask you when the United States began establishing forts and military bases and outposts beyond its, well, initially everything west of the 13 colonies was foreign territory, but once all that had been colonized and they were on the Pacific Ocean looking westwards, and of course on the East Coast looking down to the Caribbean, when did America start to establish bases off its east and west coasts?
U.S. expansion beyond the North American continent itself begins around the mid-19th century with the seizure acquisition of small islands, mostly for birdshit, guano, which was an important fertilizer of the time. But it's really in 1898, around 1898, in the last decade of the 19th century, that one sees a major expansion beyond the continent. Of course, with the seizure of Hawaii, the conquest of the Hawaiian monarchy with the help of the Dole corporate interests and other colonists from the mainland United States who helped encourage the U.S. government to seize Hawaii formally. And then the War of 1898 with Spain, where one sees the United States defeat the dissolving Spanish empire and seize colonies in Puerto Rico in the Caribbean, as well as a de facto colony in Cuba, and then colonies in the Philippines and Guam. Around the same time, the U.S. government seizes American Samoa, where people still have a kind of fourth-class U.S. citizenship. The people living in all the colonies don't have the citizenship rights that people like I have living in California. And then there's continued conquest. And in the case of the U.S. Virgin Islands, the United States government buys the Virgin Islands from Denmark during World War I. And then it is, as my book shows, in World War II itself, and then continuing into the post-World War II period, one sees the creation of a collection of U.S. military bases abroad that is larger than that of any people, country, or empire in world history, a collection of foreign extraterritorial bases larger than that of any empire in world history. And this begins during the war with thousands of base sites around the world that the U.S. military occupies, frequently built with the labor of locals, the low paid, if that, labor of locals. And then it becomes an infrastructure of bases that remains in place throughout the Cold War period and to this day. While the total number of bases shrunk after the war, there is a permanent infrastructure of bases that the U.S. government has maintained since World War II that has expanded and contracted in various ways. Most dramatically, of course, the collection of bases has expanded in the greater Middle East in the period really since the 1980s and the enunciation of the Carter Doctrine, which President Reagan then followed. And this infrastructure of bases in the Middle East has been a critical part of what made it all too easy for U.S. leaders to lead the country into disastrous wars against Iraq and Afghanistan in particular, but equally disastrous wars in Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and beyond.
And many of these bases are situated on islands. There are all these island bases, like American Samoa, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Okinawa, Guantanamo Base in Cuba, Johnston Atoll, Kwajalein Atoll. There are all these islands, and then there's Diego Garcia, of course. There are all these islands which were and are perfect places to build bases, and they're just like the forts of the Western United, well, all around the United States. These bases kind of serve two roles: to project American military power and influence, but also economic power. They're way stations for commercial shipping and the rest of it. And all these, many of these islands, their bases were established through the dispossession of people. People were driven off these islands.
Indeed, the base on Diego Garcia, which, as I mentioned, was how I, in many ways, came to this work. The base where in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the U.S. government, again with the help of the British government, forcibly displaced the entire Chagossian people and dumped them in exile.
The Chagossian people, they're called.
Chagossian people, yeah, the people of the Chagos Islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. This history, the way in which the Chagossian suffered, is tells a much bigger story of how the U.S. empire has worked in the post-World War II era.
Get into that in a little bit of detail.
Yeah, islands have become increasingly important as a way to project U.S. military power and U.S. economic power, rather than seizing large swaths of territory in the post-World War II era, the era of decolonization, when the U.S. government supported at least some, but definitely not all, decolonization efforts. The United States government, its leaders, military and political leaders, saw islands as a key way to maintain U.S. influence and control around the world, to deploy the U.S. military, but also to exert economic and political forms of influence and power.
And so Diego Garcia, talk about specifically Diego Garcia and the Chagossians.
So Diego Garcia is exemplary of this strategy, what U.S. Navy personnel, officers described as a strategic island concept. And that's the concept that led to the creation of a base on Diego Garcia and leads to the investigation of U.S. military bases being built on islands around the globe. And it becomes a justification for maintaining key U.S. bases in places like Guam and elsewhere around the world. U.S. leaders looked for islands that were lightly populated, where they could either displace the local people or not have to worry about them, and from which the U.S. military could build bases and then project power. Diego Garcia, again, is symbolic.
It's right in the middle of the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, it's far from virtually everywhere. It's 1,000 miles due south of India and halfway between Africa and Indonesia. So it's far from everywhere, but also relatively close to a large swath of the globe, from southern Africa to the Middle East to South Asia and East Asia, which meant for the U.S. military that it became a place from which they could project air and naval power in particular, and threaten the likes of now China and Iran. The base on Diego Garcia became a key launch pad for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And how many people were living on Diego Garcia? How many Chagosians were there, and what happened to them?
So at the time, there were about 1,500 to 2,000 Chagosians.
And they just drove them out. They just said, you're getting out.
Precisely. The history of how the Chagosians were displaced 1,200 miles away to the western Indian Ocean islands of Mauritius and the Seychelles is complicated. It took place over about 5 years. Initially, people were prevented from going home when they were left for vacations or medical care. Later, they were herded onto overcrowded cargo ships and deported 1,200 miles away. In the process on Diego Garcia, as people were awaiting their deportation, U.S. military personnel and British government agents herded all the Chagosians' pet dogs into sealed cargo sheds, where they then proceeded to gas them with the exhaust from U.S. Navy vehicles, and then burned the carcasses of Chagosians' pet dogs as the Chagosians looked on. And as one of the Chagosians' lawyers has pointed out, this sent a pretty strong message about what might happen if the Chagosians resisted their deportation. Of course, Chagosians have resisted. They protested being deported at the time, and since they arrived in exile, they have protested and demanded the right to go home. And they've been leading a very long struggle, now more than 50 years in exile, demanding the U.S. and British governments allow them to go back home. Britain was involved because it claimed Diego Garcia and the other Chagos Islands as a colony. And in fact, at the suggestion of U.S. government officials, Britain created its last colony, its last created colony that they called the British Indian Ocean Territory. And this enabled the creation of the base and the deportation of the Chagosians. In recent years, the International Court of Justice and the UN have said that this creation of a new colony in the era of decolonization was unlawful, and that Mauritius, the government of independent Mauritius, is the lawful sovereign over the Chagos Islands. So this was very encouraging for the Chagosians. They supported the Mauritian government's case at the International Court of Justice. And now it looks like Chagosians are closer to going home than they've been in 50 years. But they're still not home. There are negotiations underway now between the United Kingdom and Mauritius, where we also know that the U.S. government is playing a key behind-the-scenes role in those negotiations. But the Chagosians are still demanding justice, and we hope that they will be home sometime soon.
No, I mean, there's like 800 U.S. bases around the world. There's so many of them that we could talk about. They're all fascinating. I want to ask you, David Vine, what's the sovereignty situation in these bases? Who holds sovereignty over the bases, over the lands on which these bases sit? And there's obviously a whole spectrum from the base in Guam or in the U.S. Virgin Islands versus, you know, Vonsdrecht Air Force Base in the Netherlands, which is a Dutch base, but I gather there may be U.S. nuclear weapons there. There is a U.S. military facility there that I've been told is the Netherlands holds no sovereignty over it. I don't know if this is true or not. So there's a whole spectrum. Talk about the sovereignty issue. Who owns these lands? And what rights does the American military have within these bases vis-a-vis the host country?
It's a great question. And indeed, it shows the way in which U.S. military bases abroad, that is U.S. bases in foreign lands, are kinds of mini colonies. They are a form of 20th and 21st century U.S. imperialism, or one of the ways in which U.S. imperialism in the 20th and 21st century has been defined by this collection, this growing collection of U.S. military bases on other people's lands. And as you rightly pointed out, there's a spectrum of control and sovereignty that the U.S. government exercises on these bases. In indeed in what are U.S. colonies, and they're frequently called territories, but they are in a colonial relationship with the United States, places like Guam and Puerto Rico. The U.S. government, the U.S. military really is the sovereign. There is no question.
These are referred to as non-self-governing territories.
Right. These places still remain on the UN's list of non-self-governing territories. Guam in particular does. And then in